Again, we want to thank VLoop for sponsoring this episode. John, for those new listeners, what's VLoop?
VLoop is a fantastic website that allows people to upload video very easily and then tag their athletes through putting their email in the program and adding them to their team. And athletes can then go on and see the footage that you wanted to show them, see the technique you want them to improve at. They can learn outside of practice. So it's a great, easy website that's going to help your program. So you should check it out today.
And for all you Coach Your Brains Out listeners, we have a 1 month free trial at vloop.io/join. After that, it's $10 a month. Coaches, check it out. I think you and your teams will get a lot out of it. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out. I'm Billy Allen.
I'm Niels Nielsen.
And I'm John Mayer. And today we are with Dr. Carl McGowan, who is the head coach at BYU from 1989 to 2002. Where they won two NCAA championships. He's also been a longtime contributor to the U.S. national team. He's coached seven different Olympic games. He has his PhD from the University of Oregon, one of the founders of Gold Medal Squared, which has been a game changer for coaches all around the world. Dr. McGowan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun for me to get to talk to you guys.
The honor's all ours. So today we're talking about motor learning. Start out, what is motor learning and why is it important?
Well, I taught at BYU in the College of Health and Human Performance. So it's a physical education class that students had to take at BYU. And I don't know if any of you majored in physical education, but there's exercise physiology and there's biomechanics and there's, I don't know, anatomy, and there's motor learning. So it's one of the sciences that supports the major of physical education. At our school, they call it health and human performance.
Why is it important? Why do we need to know about it?
Oh, why is it important? Well, I don't know. My students never did think it was important. But if you're going to be a teacher, if you're going to be a coach, you want your kids to learn as much as possible, as soon as possible. And motor learning talks about that. It says, if you're trying to teach someone, if you're trying to coach someone, do these things, do it like this, and learning will be more effective than if you're not doing it like that. And so clearly, if we're coaching, we want it to be more effective. And there are some principles that say, do it this way, and you'll be better.
And then where should coaches get those principles from?
Yeah,
I think traditionally, it's from what their coaches taught them or what they like to do as a player. What should it be based on?
They've done little questionnaires and I've asked coaches everywhere, where did you learn to coach? And the most common answer is always, I coached the way I was coached. And of course, that doesn't produce any kind of new stuff. And pretty soon you've got a long trail of I'm coaching the way I was coached going on. And it's not the way we want to do it. So there's a science. They do experiments in all kinds of things that say, this is a good way to do it. This is not a good way to do it. So where we think you should learn to coach is find out the laws of learning. People have been studying the laws of learning for, I don't know, 100 years now. So there's a nice body of knowledge that says, do these things.
And can you go into what the laws of learning are?
Well, there are 100 of them. There are 1,000 of them.
We got a couple hours, so no, I'm just kidding. I wanted to go through, I think, some of the pillars of motor learning, some of the stuff I know you guys cover in Gold Medal Squared. And the first one would be specificity and kind of what that means and why we need to know what that means.
Well, it's certainly one of the most important concepts of coaching and therefore of motor learning. And in our coaching clinic, the very first session that we have 3-day coaching clinics. The very first PowerPoint that we present is introduction to motor learning. So we think it's important. So we get after it right now in the beginning. We're asking this question about motor programs. And we spend a little bit of time talking about the mind is the athlete and the body just does what it's told. And so if the mind is the athlete, the mind must tell the body certain things, certain commands. And so we're wondering about these commands that the body is receiving. And one really important question is going to be this. Are these commands general or are they specific? And what we mean by general is if I have this set of stored commands up in my brain, can I use them to spike a volleyball? Can I use them to throw a football? Can I use them to serve a tennis ball? Can I use this motor program that I have for throwing, hitting kinds of things? Can I use it in lots of places? And if I can use it in lots of places, then it's a general thing, can be utilized here, there, and everywhere. Or it may be that these motor programs are specific and they can only be used for whatever this limited skill set that you have is. So you could use it for spiking, but you couldn't use it for throwing a football. You need a different motor program. And so you can imagine if you're in a volleyball practice and you want to work on serving, you might do a couple of things. You might get a gun and have the gun hit serves at your receivers, or you might have somebody just serve to your receivers. And depending on whether motor programs are general or specific, you might think of doing one thing or you might think of doing the other thing, depending on what you know and believe about specificity of ability. There's a man named Franklin Henry, who was a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, that was considered the father of motor learning. And so in 1958, Franklin Henry wrote in a research paper, it is no longer possible to justify the concept of unitary abilities, such as coordination and agility, since the evidence shows that these abilities are specific to the task or activity. That wasn't Franklin Henry's opinion. He had done some science, if you would, some research, and he found what he just said, you know, or what he wrote back in 58. It is no longer possible to justify the concept of unitary or general abilities, since the evidence shows that these abilities are specific to the task or activity. So if you're going to coach and you're going to coach effectively, we could talk about how narrow the margins for winning and losing are. But if you're going to coach, you need to know, general or specific.
How narrow are the lines between winning and losing?
We just lost to Ohio State. BYU lost to Ohio State, whatever it was, 34-32 and 25-23, and then we gave up. But here's some standings from the Mountain Pacific Sports Federation. You guys played in the MPSF once upon a time. Where did you play, Nils?
Northridge.
That's what I thought. It was Northridge. And John played at Pepperdine.
Yeah, the good school.
Here's the 2013 MPSF standings. That year, BYU was 21-3, and Irvine was 18-6, and Long Beach State was 18-6, and UCLA was 16-8. Pepperdine was 13-11. Stanford, 12-12. CBU, Cal Baptist, they had some guys from Brazil that were only eligible that year. And then finally, UCSB. And BYU is 21-3. I may have said that. And Santa Barbara was 11-13. They made the playoffs, though. They were number 8. And it turns out that BYU that year in that league won 52.9% of the available points. Irvine won 52.6% of the available points. And then we go on and on and on. And finally, the 8th place team was UC Santa Barbara at 11-13, and they won 50.1% of the available points. And so we just said that BYU won 52.9% of the available points. Santa Barbara won 50.1% of the available points. So that's what, 2.8% more points that BYU won than Santa Barbara won. And we were 21-3. And they were 11-13. So I think, you know, that's incredibly small to go from first to eighth. And we're only talking about 2.8%. And it made that much difference in the league that year.
Yeah, that's a really thin margin.
Going back to the idea of specific skills, you mentioned that, like, yeah, I could see how football wouldn't transfer to volleyball, et cetera. Did you say agility was specific to the sport? Like, would a soccer player who's quick on the soccer field be quick on the volleyball court, or is that different as well? Is that specific to the sport?
Yeah, it's everything. If we do the research, if we look at the data, we find that the thing that Henry wrote back in 1958 is completely and totally supported in 2016 with any kind of research that might be done. And so Henry said this: it is no longer possible to justify the concept of general abilities. And so any kind of agility is very specific. Any kind of coordination is very specific. And he goes on to say, the evidence shows that these abilities are specific to the task or activity. So you can spend a lot of time wherever doing agility activities that aren't going to help you be agile when you play volleyball, or help you be agile when you play soccer if you're doing volleyball. Abilities are incredibly specific. And I read a book not so long ago by Brent Rushall. It was published in 2009. The Neural and Psychological Bases of Baseball Pitching. He said this, 2009, the specificity of movement patterns is a scientifically established principle of human exercise. There has been no wavering on this valid phenomenon over the last 50 years. Coaches persist, however, in violating this basic principle with dubious arguments, false premises, and distortion of facts. And we can go on. We can get in a book by Richard Schmidt, who was a PhD guy at UCLA and at USC. He went from USC to UCLA. He writes this. He says, a common misconception is that fundamental abilities like agility in soccer can be trained through various drills and other activities. For example, athletes are often given various quickening exercises with the hope that these exercises would train some fundamental ability to be quick, allowing quicker responses in their particular sport. And then Schmidt, who's written this textbook in 2011, he says, there is no general ability to be quick, to balance, or to use vision. A learner may acquire additional skill at a drill, but this learning does not transfer to the main skill of interest. And that was the most widely sold textbook, published in 2011, not so far away from 2016, saying motor programs are incredibly specific.
That kind of takes me into the next question I had, and I think it's related, getting into transfer. This is another big one for volleyball. I know a lot of people will work on serve-receive by doing partner passing. They think they're going to improve their players' platforms by passing back and forth at the net. What do you think about that?
Will
that
transfer?
People do it on the same side of the net. They'll pass back and forth.
Against the wall.
Or against the wall. And they think that'll transfer to being good in serve-receive or good with their platform. Can you let us know your thoughts on that?
I can. Here's Schmidt again. Henry was a father of motor learning, so I don't know where Schmidt was, but he was esteemed as a great scientist. He passed away last year, and he's younger than I am, and it's sad to see him go, but he says this: there has been a great deal of research conducted concerning transfer from one variation of a task to another variation of the same task. So that would be passing serves over the net, and that would be passing serves back and forth on the same side of the net, from one variation of a task to another variation of the same task. One is forced to the conclusion that the amount of motor transfer is generally quite small. And so if we say that motor programs are specific, we have really said in the same breath that there is going to be very small amounts of transfer from this task to that task. They have to be essentially identical if we're trying to get a lot of transfer.
So Carl, when we talk about this, this comes up on our podcast, and John usually shuts down all arguments by saying, well, this is what the science says. We have no argument to that. Can you give us some specific examples of some of the experiments that led him to say that there was no or very little transfer? Like, what did they look like? How did they come to this conclusion?
Well, I actually taught school at Berkeley for a while when Henry was there. One of the experiments I remember is there's this device in motor learning labs called a stabilometer. And a stabilometer is a little teeter-totter where you can stand on one side on with one leg and on the other side with another leg and balance the teeter-totter. And we can measure how much movement there is when you're trying to do this balancing. So is that okay? Can you see what they're doing? We're standing on a stabilometer trying to balance. We're measuring your ability to balance. And then there is also in a motor learning lab, a thing called a Bachman ladder. And so I wanted to see how high you could climb up that ladder and balance it before it fell over, before you lost your balance and it crashed to the floor. And so there are two different kinds of balancing tasks right there, a stabilometer and a Bachman ladder. And if balance is a general ability, if you're good on the stabilometer, we predict that you will be what?
Good on the other one.
Yeah, you'd be good on the Bachman ladder because it's a balance task as well. So if you can balance on that, you can balance on that if abilities are general. But if abilities are specific, then the fact that you're good on one task doesn't mean you'll be good on another task. And so we're going to correlate. We're going to get 30, 40, 50 subjects. We're going to have them balance these different apparatuses. And if there is a general ability, the guy that was good on the Bachman ladder will be the guy that was good on the stabilometer. And the guy that was bad on the Bachman ladder will be the guy that was bad on the stabilometer. And so the correlation between those two tasks is going to be essentially zero if there's specificity. And if there's generality, then the correlation between those two tasks is going to be very high. And so they did those kind of experiments. There's a man named Fleischman back in the maybe the 60s. He had, I don't know, several dozen different little movement patterns that he had his subjects learn. And so we ended up with, I don't remember, it's been a long time since I looked at this kind of data, but maybe he had 50 correlations from all the different novel tasks that the subjects were doing. And I don't know, the highest correlation was like 0.2, and that has hardly any common variance. You square the correlation to get common variance. So there's 4% common variance if you got a 0.2 correlation. And there were lots of experiments done like that back in the 50s and 60s. And then they quit doing them because they kept finding the same results. And so Bren Rushall, in the book that I just told you about, The Neural and Psychological Basis of Baseball Pitching, he said, I said this already, the specificity of movement patterns and control is a scientifically established principle of human exercise. So we don't have to study it anymore. We know that that's the way things are. And here's an experiment by Green and Belvier in 2008, Exercising Your Brain, a review of human brain plasticity and training-induced learning. And they say in this experiment, human beings have an amazing capacity to learn new skills and adapt to new environments. However, several objects remain to be overcome. Arguably, the most notable impediment to this goal is that learning tends to be quite specific to the trained regimen and does not transfer to even qualitatively similar tasks. And I could find, it would be possible for me to find 100 experiments that say that, you know. And so what Rushall says is what you guys are telling me about. Coaches persist in violating this basic principle with dubious arguments, false premises, and distortions of facts because somehow we want, athletes want, passing back and forth near the net to be helpful, but it's not.
Let's say we buy in, volleyball is very specific, we need to train it that way. The most specific we can get is playing a game. Is there room as a coach to break it down into parts, do other stuff other than playing? Talking about part versus whole, if I'm teaching hitting, is there a reason to go over just the approach, go over the arm swing on a box, etc.?
No, not an arm swing on a box. You're going to give yourself some commands to go spike a ball, right? You're going to take, I don't know, four steps. You're going to swing your arms. You're going to do whatever you're going to do to spike the ball. And you can just work on spiking. You don't have to play doubles or six on six or anything. We could call it whole work on spiking. But if you start doing part work on spiking, then all the time you spend on that box is not going to serve you well. The neural commands given to spike a ball have nothing to do with standing on a box and hitting it. You got to deal with the wind. You got to get your partner can't set. You got all of this stuff that you got to deal with if you want to become a good spiker. And hitting it off a box isn't going to help you develop any of those other things that are essential for being a good beach player. I'm going to read one more thing to you. If we believe in specificity, then we also believe in transfer. And here's another study that says, in the 30 whole part studies reviewed, not one favored teaching methods that use the part or progressive part methods of instruction. In the majority of studies, some variation of the whole method was associated with superior learning. So we have a little problem sometimes defining what's a whole and what's a part. And some coaches think that if I'm working on spiking, I'm doing part practice. But I'm only doing part practice with spiking if I'm working on an arm swing, or I'm working on an approach, or I'm working on, I don't know, whatever else I would work on if I wanted to break spiking into parts. So if I'm working on spiking, I can be working on it either with whole practice or with part practice. And the fact that I'm only working on spiking doesn't get into the definition of whole versus part. We're just talking about this skill that you're trying to learn. How do you practice it? Do you practice it in the whole, or do you break it down into parts and stand on benches and do all the things that lots of coaches do?
Where do progressions come in when learning a new skill? Would you ever break the skill up? And what does that look like when you say, okay, we're going to work on your feet. We're going to work on your double arm lift. We're going to work on your arm swing. And I know nowadays it's sacrilege to stand a kid on a box and have them, you know, work on just reaching up high for however long.
Not in any way justified. We've got five bodies of knowledge that deal with standing on a box and hitting balls. And those five bodies of knowledge are all the specificity research. And then we have some transfer research, quite a bit, not some, but an extensive body of knowledge. We've got a couple of other things that we didn't talk about. One of them we briefly mentioned was whole versus part practice. And then there are a couple of other things called state-dependent remembering and random versus blocked practice. So we have all of these bodies of knowledge, hundreds of studies in all of them, and they all say exactly what they should say if abilities are specific. But here we are. I want to teach someone how to spike. And if I just play volleyball all day, I'll hardly get any spiking practice, but I might get the right kind of spiking practice if I were playing all day, you know, but, or I'd get beat and I wouldn't get to play anymore. But I probably want to have some progressions. And so the question is, what should the progressions be like? And in general, when we ask this question, we find out that there are two rules for progressions. Progressions should be limited in number. So I don't want to have 10 progressions that I use to teach someone how to spike. I want to have maybe only none. Maybe I don't want any progressions. I just want to have them run and jump and hit balls. And maybe that'll be that. That's my progression. So I get one progression. So that's one of the rules for progressions. And the other one is the progressions that are used should be as much like the game of volleyball as possible, because we need appropriate regulatory stimuli. And appropriate, or let me ask it a different way, what regulates spiking? What's the hard part about spiking?
Timing.
Yeah, timing. The ball goes up and down and it's windy and I got to time it. And so my ability to regulate timing is the most important part of being a good spiker. If I can have really good timing, I can end up being as good as I can be anyhow. Maybe not really good, but as good as I can be. So here are the rules for progressions. They should be limited in number. That doesn't mean we should have five of them. You know, how limited can we get here? And the ones that are used should be as much like the game of volleyball as possible. So when we're going to have progressions, we need appropriate, and here's the key word, regulatory stimuli. So in volleyball, we can ask, what regulates passing? What's the hard part about passing?
Reading.
What's the hard part about spiking? What's the hard part about blocking? You know, what's the hard part about all of these skills? Well, there's a ball, and the ball goes up and down and left and right and all over the place. And so as much as possible, I want to have that kind of stuff that I'm practicing. And all the time that I'm spending on a bench is just not very helpful for me. And there's some research that shows that the uglier practice is, the more complete the transfer is. We want practice to be clean all the time. And so lots of times we'll throw balls right to the passer, or lots of times we'll toss balls right to the spiker. We'll do these things that make practice, oh, geez, you just passed really good, 30 balls in a row. But I threw 30 balls in a row right to you. And that kind of practice doesn't transfer very much playing volleyball.
Can you give us an example of when you would ever need a progression?
In a couple of weeks, we're having a coaching clinic in Concordia University there in Irvine. If you watch us teach forearm passing, we're going to have some keys that we want you to learn. And so we're going to start out in a blocked setting where we're just tossing you the ball, coming right to you. And then we've got another key and we'll throw it right to you. And then we've got another key and we'll throw it right to you. Essentially, it's the same progression that we used it here and we used it here and we used it here. So I don't know how you want to count that. Do you want to count that as three progressions, or is it the same one three different times? I want to count it as it's the same one three different times. And then before the session is over, before we're through with you and forearm passing, we're going to start throwing some balls to you. And then we're going to start serving some balls to you. And we're going to be doing that all within the first hour of teaching you how to pass. So maybe we add three progressions. And that's the most that I can think of. If we're going to teach you how to spike, we're going to throw some balls up in the air that you need a time, that you need to go hit. And we'll talk to you about three keys here. We'll talk to you about what we want your footwork to be like, right, left, right, left. But we want you to run and jump and hit a ball while you're thinking about your feet. And then we're going to teach you, now we want you to get a double arm lift, and we're going to throw a ball and you're going to run and jump and hit it. And so it's the same drill again. And we want you to do some kind of whatever you call it. We call it bow and arrow thing. And it's the same progression used to get us through three different keys.
And so if you're coaching your team at BYU, are you doing those progressions every day? Or is it one time to introduce the keys and then the rest of the season you're just doing it in a game-like setting?
Yeah, but there will be times when we have fundamental review. And so it wouldn't be unusual if you came to a BYU practice that we might say in our tutoring session at the beginning of practice that lasts for 15 minutes or something. All right, we're going to have a fundamental review of forearm passing. And we would go through the keys and we'd do some little baby stuff, and then that would be that. And we'd have spent 15 minutes, hopefully not wasted, but maybe, because we weren't passing real serves the whole time.
So Dr. McGowan, that's BYU. They're a really good college team. What about my 12s girls team? Does age matter when it comes to this?
The principles of learning, and that's what we're talking about now. This is one of the strongest principles for volleyball coaches. The principles of learning don't care how old you are, and they don't care what sex you are. They're still the principles of learning. And so your little 12-year-olds aren't going to learn as fast as your college guys are going to learn, but they need to have the same environment in place to learn the best that they can learn right away. And they won't do it right away because they're 12-year-olds.
What about if I'm a visual learner or I'm a fast twitch athlete? Does it work the same for everybody?
Yeah, I was reading an article today where some guy was talking about there are different kinds of learning styles. And there's a coach named Mike Hebert. He coached women's volleyball. He coached at Minnesota when he was done, and he had been in the coaching profession, I don't know, 40 years or something. Mike Hebert. He's now down in San Diego. He played golf today, I'm sure, with Rudy Sawara. I'm reading an article today about the different ways of learning, different learning, whatever they call them, a visual learner, a kinesthetic learner, all of these different kinds of learning. And Mike Hebert and I have argued this in the past often, and I've sent him study after study after study after study that says there aren't these different kinds of learners that you keep telling me about. They aren't visual and kinesthetic. All of the people that are learning with the same principles. There's an article that I just read yesterday by Anders Ericsson. It's talking about the principles of learning are the same for everybody, for the piano and for dancing and for volleyball, for whatever. The laws of learning are the same, whatever you're trying to learn, however old you are, whatever sex you are, whatever. There are thousands of laws of learning, of course. But this one, specificity, is the one that should be the most important one for you and for me and for everybody coaching volleyball.
That's plenty of info to digest in one sitting. We'll be back next week with part two of Motor Learning with Carl McGowan. Thanks for listening to another episode of Coach Your Brains Out. Please subscribe on iTunes and write a review. So why do you think players and coaches are so resistant? Is it just tradition? Is it because they don't believe it works? Wouldn't you rather be hitting volleyballs instead of standing on a box?
I would. Coaches persist in violating this basic principle. Why? I can't understand why. I don't know why. But I sent John a record of BYU in the 25 years that they've been in the Mountain Pacific Sports Federation.
The document that Dr. McGowan sent was BYU's record for 25 years, which is the best record in the MPSF substantially over all the teams that have played.
We've believed in specificity from the very beginning. I went to graduate school in the 1970s and studied motor learning. And so I've believed in specificity for a long time, and we've always played volleyball with specificity in mind at BYU. And if specificity sucks, then BYU should suck, you know, because they believe it with their whole hearts. So I don't know why it's such a hard sell.
If specificity and motor learning principles were so important in that success that BYU has had, can you maybe take us through the structure of a practice? What does that look like that's different than what other schools had done or have been doing?
I don't know about other schools. So a BYU practice has something that we call pre-practice. And we want you to come in and do a little bit of stuff, about 5 minutes worth of some push-ups maybe and some sit-ups and throw some medicine balls around. And then we might have some movement patterns for you. Do a few pancakes, do a few block trips, do some spiking, a whole bunch of things we can have you do for pre-practice. And we won't do a whole bunch of things. We'll just do part of it today and part of it tomorrow and the next day. And then we'll have a meeting and we'll talk about here's what's up with practice today. And then we'll have some tutoring. And tutoring is where we're working on something, some fundamental skill. They come out and they start passing balls. And we're going to warm up passing balls. And then we're going to want to hit some spike serves at these guys, but we don't have anybody that can hit it hard enough or often enough. Pretty soon your arms wear out. So if you come in our gym, you're going to see us with a gun that spins balls and they come out real fast to our passers. And so it's unfortunate that we train at altitude, but at our altitude, nobody can hit the spike serves that we need to hit to go down to sea level. And so we're going to pass serves and we're going to pass float serves. And there are some guys that have good spike serves. Taylor Sander had a good spike serve, so he would hit spike serves at us. And his brother's getting pretty good, so he would hit spike serves at us. And we're going to keep track. You're going to have a certain number of balls that are served to you. And we want to know how many of them you pass perfectly. And we're going to do it for, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes. Then we're going to wander off and do something else, some other tutoring, or play some 4-on-4 or play some 5-on-3 or do some kind of stuff. And then we're going to have some kind of competition where you're playing the other outside hitters. And we're going to have we call it a middle blocker tournament or an outside hitter tournament. Then we're going to play some 6-on-6 and we're going to keep track of that side out efficiency. And we're going to have numbers for that as well. We've got a guy that now can data volley everything. And then we're going to do some more serving and receiving. Maybe we'll have a middle blocker tournament to do serving and receiving.
Sounds like a great practice. I would like to participate that. But I actually want to go back. You use a serving machine with your passers, and I know that might be a controversial thing. John and I get into the idea of like reading, and for my understanding, when you use a serving machine, you're basically taking away that whole portion of the skill, reading a server. Is there some transfer, and with the principle of specificity, there is some sort of transfer off of a serving machine, yes?
Yeah, there is, but it's a tiny percent.
Why would you use that? Is that just a necessity for players' arms?
We don't have arms that can hit it as hard as we want, and we don't have arms that can hit 5,000 serves a day, you know, or even 500 a day. We don't have those kind of arms. So the fallback position for us is, okay, we got a machine. The machine can spin it. The machine can hit it real hard at you. And it sucks that you can't read the server, because clearly that's an important deal right there. You got to be able to read the server. But now I can get, I have no idea how much, but now maybe I can get 3% transfer, or maybe 1% transfer, and then 1% the next day. I don't know how much, not much. I understand it's not very much, but it's better than nothing. And so we have to settle. Unless we could talk you guys into coming and spiking serves at us.
So I think this is an interesting point, because a lot of teams, we want to be as specific as possible, but a lot of teams have these disadvantages, maybe of, you know, a very small roster, whatever it is. So you're just trying to get as close as you can to what it would look like in a game. And that's just the speed of a server.
Right. Yeah. And that's the best we can do. There's nothing any better than that, but it's not as good as we'd like it to be.
That's an important point to me, because part of what's going on and why myself and probably other coaches as well hold on to some of the things that we have is we know that they will work over time. It just might take too long or longer than if we have the science and better understanding of motor learning in place, we can get the players to a higher level quicker. But we know that this will work. And taking that step of faith into some of this random blocked and specificity and really diving into that is very scary, and it's not necessarily something that's known. So I know I've played teams, you know, they have seniors that have been doing block training for 4 years and they look good, and it's transferred enough so that the team looks clean and well coached, but they've been doing it for so long that they get that transfer. So it's not the best, but it's not completely worthless. It's just not as good as it could be.
That's the question. You know, could we have made it better? And we think, as far as serving is concerned, in our gym, we can't make it any better.
Beginning of practice, how long would your team meetings go?
2, 3, 4, 5 minutes. Just maybe we got some announcements. We have to tell them what we're going to do in practice as quickly as we can and without much detail, just kind of so they know. And we warmed up with our pre-practice activities. And now we're probably going to do some tutoring stuff. And by the time we get through with pre-practice and tutoring, we're as warm as we'll ever need to be. And somewhere I could say to you, the thing that is going to most make you good is the number of game-like appropriate regulatory stimulations have you had. You know, and so we also know that there is no evidence that stretching reduces injury or soreness. And so that's another line of study we could get into. Stretching doesn't help you keep from getting injured, and stretching doesn't help you keep from getting sore. And so we don't do stretching in our practices. We don't, none.
But if I have, say, a club team, say they're 14s and I only have 8 players, don't I need to spend time
no.
stretching and jogging? And we can't just play
no.
the whole time. So then what do I do? How can I play game-like if I don't have 12 people?
That's the thing I was worried about when we were talking about whole versus part practice. You can have a game-like drill, totally and completely game-like, that only has 3 people in it. So I don't have to play volleyball 6-on-6 to have game-like. I can play 2-against-1 and have game-like. Game-like means the ball goes back and forth across the net. I pass it, I set it, I spike it. You know, I play small-sided games.
Well, I think there is some confusion on the semantics of what this looks like. I think sometimes the progressions like you got into before, there's a little bit of a semantic argument. What is a progression? So as long as you understand what that looks like, I feel like game like random blocked, these things, we do get into it, and sometimes we're talking about the same thing using different words, or we're talking about different things using the same words.
Yeah, that's yes. What worries me right there. Different things, same words.
So, Carl, you've been studying motor learning for a long time. Has anything changed, or has everything just more validated what you guys studied when you first started?
Well, if we're talking about specificity, nothing's changed. If we're talking about transfer, nothing's changed. If we're talking about feedback, maybe some things have changed. I don't think they have, but the jury's still out. There's a researcher at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, named Gabriel Wolf. Gabriel Wolf says, your feedback has to be about external things. Your feedback should not be about internal things. So she talks about getting rid of body words when you're giving feedback. So we got external and internal. Internal is body words. Did your arms go this way? Did your arms go that way? Those are internal feedback. She wants us to get rid of that. I've read her stuff carefully and all of it extensively. And the very first study that she did was on a ski simulator, very much like a stabilometer. And then she did another study, stabilometer, another study, stabilometer, another study, stabilometer, another study, stabilometer, 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 stabilometer. I don't know how many that is. That's about 10 studies, all with a stabilometer as the motor skill. And then we did some more balance on an inflated disc. And then we did a balance master. And then we did an inflated disc. And here's a whole bunch more balance things. And then we got going with some golf pitch shots. And I don't know, I don't want to look at all of these things, but she's done a lot of research, published research, and never, ever once has there been anything like volleyball. I'm balancing and I'm hitting golf pitch shots and I'm doing all of this stuff. And I don't know how many of you play golf, but it's not like volleyball. You know, volleyball, the ball comes to you and you have to hit it. And in golf, the ball's just sitting there and you hit it. And so it allows different kinds of things to go on with your eyes and your reading and what have you. If you're having to hit a volleyball, it's way different than balancing on a stabilometer. Here's a statement that she has in her one of her papers. Where the performer's major goal is the learning of the correct technique, that's volleyball, I think, it might be almost impossible to come up with statements that do not refer at all to the performer's own movements. And so the research that Gabriel Wolf has done has been with all of these skills that are not in any way like volleyball. She hasn't spent a prolonged period of time teaching people to be better in these skills that she utilizes. They just test them on one day and test them on another day, and that's the end of it. Mostly the experiments last 2 or 3 or 4 days. It's not like you're going to volleyball practice for weeks and months and years. And then she says, where the performer's major goal is the learning of the correct technique, it might be almost impossible to come up with statements that do not refer at all to the performer's own movements. So if you come to the coaching clinic at Concordia, we would say to you, here's how we want you to hold your wrists and hands. And here's how we want you to swing your arms. We call it straight and simple. And those are internal feedback. And she's saying it's impossible to come up with statements that do not refer at all to the performer's own movements. And so right now, John Kessel is hot after this. I've been trying to get him to call me so we could talk about it some more. They haven't had to practice something for a long time. They haven't had to hit a volleyball that's coming to them. They haven't had to spike a volleyball that's coming to them. They haven't had to do anything at all like the movements that are in volleyball. And she even says herself, You know, it's impossible to come up with statements that do not refer to the performer's own movements. So we've changed some of our keys a tiny little bit. We're going to say now, hold your wrists and hands together so that you've made a good platform, and try to put the onus on the platform part of the skill as opposed to the wrists and hands part of the skill. But we didn't change all of our keys because we think we don't need to, because what we've got going is good.
I think it'll be interesting to see if she follows up and is able to dive deeper into that research and find something.
I phoned her.
More volleyball-like.
She was a student of Richard Schmidt, and I was a student of Richard Schmidt. I was on sabbatical at USC once upon a time. And so I knew Richard Schmidt, so I thought I could phone Gabriel Wolf. And so I phoned her, and I told her, you know, what about this and this and this and this? And she said, okay, I'm going to have one of my former students talk to you. And so a guy from maybe New Mexico State called me. I can't remember his name, but I have it written down somewhere, of course. And I said to him, you know what? We need to do an experiment that is like a volleyball class where you spend time learning, and you're going to say this and I'm going to say that. We're going to have different kind of feedback. And I sent emails out to about 30 different professors and volleyball coaches saying, we'd like to do some research. Does anybody in your department need to do a thesis or a little research? And nobody ever got back to me. This was, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago. And so in my opinion, and it's an opinion right now, we haven't done the right kind of research to find out if she's going to change the way we talk about feedback or not. It hasn't been done.
That's a bummer. I've been having a good time trying to come up with creative analogies.
We'll be excited to see what comes of it. We've taken a lot of your time and really appreciate all that you've shared. And just wanted to close with one or two more questions. One of them is, what are the biggest abuses of motor learning that you most often see?
Yeah, I don't see abuses.
Because people are on their best behavior around you?
No, they just disregard motor learning whatsoever. So they're not abusing it. They're just disregarding it completely. And you can get on the internet and they're jumping through hoops. And I just got something from Kessel a couple of days ago where something about neural training, and he had all of this stuff going on. They were doing running around, doing silly stuff, training their nervous system. The AVCA, hopefully Kathy DeBoer won't listen to our podcast, but the AVCA has that weekly, whatever it's called, weekly hint or something. It's terrible. The president of our American Volleyball Coaches Association, that's the kind of stuff that goes on those tips of the week, that she allows that to happen is just...
Yeah, it seems like they just try to be as creative as possible.
Yeah, just as bizarre as possible.
Yeah, we actually had an episode discussing one of those and how ridiculous the tip of the week was. But I guess kind of to go into that too, is a frustration I've had is that I, the best of my abilities, follow a lot of these principles. And then I see a team that is jumping through hoops and maybe has some better athletes and they have good results. So how do you respond to that? You know, when you get that complaint from coaches, like I'm still losing to these teams that are doing blocked reps and ungame-like reps and abusing motor learning.
Come to our coaching clinic and we'll make you better. When BYU first came in the league, we played Pepperdine. It was our very first match in January of 1990. And Marv and I were friends from a long time. And so we played Pepperdine and the match was over in about 10 minutes. We had 5,000 people come on the field house. And if they came late, they missed it because the match was over. And that year we won 5 matches and lost 22. And it sucked. It was just like you said, you know, we're doing all this good stuff. And I'm sure none of these coaches are doing this good stuff. And the next year it got worse. We won 2 matches and lost 27, but I believed in it and we kept doing it. And by the 5th year we were in the league, we were ranked 2nd in the nation. And so it took a while to get all of these things in place, but eventually we got it in place. And then John has the record. If you really and truly are doing this stuff, you're going to end up better than the people you're playing against.
What do you attribute that lag time to Was that your system's not quite dialed in on how to teach it? Was it other things that didn't have to do with the actual play? What do you attribute that to?
We were first notified about BYU is going to have a team in the summer before we had the team. And so we didn't get to recruit anybody. We just had the guys that were left over from the club team. It was just some guys that randomly showed up. And so we didn't have good volleyball players. But the second year of the program, we ended up recruiting Hugh McCutcheon, who coached a gold medal and was he was an All-American volleyball player. Jason Watson, Pat Sinclair, those guys all ended up being on national teams somewhere. And it takes a while, as you know. You can't learn volleyball in a heartbeat. It takes a long time to get better. And it took us 5 years, but we thought that was pretty good.
If you can go back to that time when you first started coaching, other than hire Nils and his iron shoulder, jump serve you guys balls all at practice, what would you tell yourself? And is there anything you would do different?
Well, I wish I knew more about block and defense. I wish I knew more about putting an offense in place. But I thought the way I taught forearm passing then is very much the way I would teach forearm passing today. Very much the way I will teach forearm passing today. But if I get 1% better than you today and tomorrow and the next day, if I can get just 1% better than you in the next 21 days, I think it is, I'll be 25% better than you. And it's another example of how thin the margins are. You know, 1%, 1%, 1%, and all of a sudden, I'm a lot better. And when I was first coaching, I didn't know what I know now. Not too long ago, I was in Switzerland coaching a team over there, and I was 69 years old. And they asked me, what age is it when you're the best coach that you can be? And I told them, of course, 69, of course, that's the best age. And then while I was there, I had my birthday. And they asked me again, well, now what's the best age for knowing the most you can? I told them, well, 70. And I look at some of my practice plans that I had back when we were 2 and 27 and 5 and 22. And we knew motor learning, but it's embarrassing to look at the practices that we had going on. It's just embarrassing. And so you get better at your job.
Well, that's a good place to close it. Inspiring for all of us to continue to improve. Is there anything else you'd like to share about Gold Medal Squared? I know the website, the blog, toolbox, any of that that our listeners can check out? Other clinics coming up?
I'm an old guy, as I just told you, and I don't pay very much attention to the coaching clinics anymore. I know that they have one at Washington this weekend that I'm going to go to, and then there's one at BYU that I'm going to go to. And that's it. So Gold Medal Squared is on their own as far as I'm concerned. And we've done a nice job. There's competition out there, of course. And we like the product that we put out. And we've had hundreds of coaches win things that they never would have won if they hadn't been to our clinics. And so that's one of the things we talk about. It's not important that Marv has won all these NC2A championships. It's not important that Hugh won a gold medal. It's not important that Doug and Marv have won gold medals. What's important is, how do the coaches that come to our clinics, how do they do? How do their teams do? And we think that their teams do wonderfully well. And we've got a lot of young coaches that have won stuff that we don't think they would have won if they hadn't come to our clinics.
Awesome. Well, we hope after this podcast, we're all going to be winners too.
Okay.
Thanks again, Carl, for all the time and knowledge. And I agree. All the keys and a lot of the feedback that I use in my coaching is, I think, straight from your mouth and straight from all the Gold Medal Squared information.
You.
So thanks for doing all you've done.
To be on the Coach Your Brains Out. So I already coached my brains out a long time ago.
that's getting in there. That's fantastic. Thanks a lot.
All right. Good luck to you guys.